You're listening to a special podcast of the Voltaire Lecture, given on the 20th of March, 2013, which is presented by the British Humanist Association. This year's lecture was given by Harvard College Professor and Johnson Family Professor of Psychology at Harvard University, Steven Pinker, who is also known for his many books and possibly fabulous hair. You can hear our interview with Steven on episode 179 of The Pod Delusion. The Pod Delusion is a weekly news magazine program about interesting things, from science to culture to politics, all from a skeptical rationalist point of view. You can find out more at poddelusion.co.uk. But for now, here's Andrew Copson introducing the lecture.
Good evening. My name's Andrew Copson. I'm the Chief Executive of the British Humanist Association, and I have two functions here this evening. One is to be a brief trailer for our other events. This year. Later on this year in June, we have the Shelley Lecture, our annual lecture in Oxford, which is being given by the American novelist Rebecca Goldstein. And later on in June, we have our annual conference, which is in Leeds. Anyone here from Leeds tonight? Exactly. Well, that's why we have to go to them, you see. Okay, so we're all going to go up to Leeds. And our annual conference this year will have Zoe Margolis, Jim Alpidi, Sue Blackmore, Melinda Gebbi, Adam Rutherford, Robin Ince, and many more acts. And it's Leeds, which, to be honest, no one visits very often. So this is your chance. We can block it on YouTube from Leeds, right? No one registered in Leeds can view this video afterwards. And then the second thing for me to do is to introduce the Voltaire Lecture and your chair for this evening. The Voltaire Lectures Fund was established by the legacy of Theodore Besterman, biographer of Voltaire, for lectures on any aspect of scientific or philosophical thought or human activity as affected by or with particular reference to humanism. And the British Humanist Association now oversees that fund. Previous Voltaire lecturers have included Herman Bondi, Sir Bernard Crick, Richard Dawkins, Anthony Flew, Michael Foote, Robert Hind, Ludovic Kennedy, Simon Blackburn, Ray Tallis, Dick Taverne, and many more. Our lecturer this evening is a very worthy addition to that roll of honour. It's not me, who is it? This is my third function of the evening, tell you to turn your phones off, not just to silent. Our Voltaire lecture this evening is a worthy addition to that roll call of honour. But before we get to the excitement that is him, I want to introduce to you the chair of our lecture this evening, who is also here in his first big public outing as our new president, the new president of the British Humanist Association. So I hope that you'll give him a welcome that recognises that, Jim Alcalidi.
Thank you very much. This is all very exciting, my second outing, and I feel among friends. I should say that the first time I met Stephen was back in the summer of the year before last, when he was the second guest on my Radio 4 programme, Life Scientific, and we were very excited to have him very early on in the series, and his book, in fact, the subject of tonight's lecture, had just come out, so it was a real coup that he happened to be over at the time. But our paths crossed a few months earlier than that, not physically, but electronically. I had a book that had just come out in the States on the history of medieval science in the Islamic world, and I was very pleased that on the back of the US edition was a very nice endorsement, a quote from Steven Pinker. Ooh, that was a real coup. And then I got an email from Steven, very, very, very sweet, very polite, saying, I've just received a copy of your book in the post with a quote by me. Or rather, attributed to me. I've never seen your book before in my life until now. Whoops. And, you know, so I sent a very apologetic email back, and it turns out that his book had been reviewed alongside mine in BBC Focus magazine, and someone had got the wrong end of the stick, and Chinese Whispers got back to American publishers, and they attributed this quote to him, and that it wasn't him. So I don't know if you've read the book or not, but anyway, I'm in testament just to how sweet a man Stephen is that he didn't hold this against me. Well, certainly not that I'm aware of, anyway. Let me tell you a little bit about Steven, his work and his career. Steven Pinker was born in 1954 in the English-speaking Jewish community of Montreal in Canada. He earned a bachelor's degree in experimental psychology at McGill University and then moved to Cambridge, Massachusetts in 1976, where he spent most of his career bouncing back and forth between Harvard and MIT. And I won't list the every stage of his career as he went to and fro between those two august institutions. He's currently Harvard College professor and the Johnston Family Professor in the Department of Psychology. He's also spent 2 years in California, both at Stanford and the University of California, Santa Barbara. Steven Pinker is an experimental psychologist who's interested in all aspects of language and mind. Much of his initial research was in visual cognition and the ability to imagine shapes, recognize faces and objects, and direct attention within the visual field. But beginning in graduate school, he cultivated an interest in language, particularly language development in children. And this topic eventually took over his research activities. Of course, in 1994, he began his popular writing. He published the first of 5 books written for a general audience, The Language Instinct, which was an introduction to all aspects of language, held together by the idea that language is a biological adaptation. This was followed in 1997 by How the Mind Works, which offered a similar synthesis of the rest of the mind, from vision and reasoning to emotions, humor, and art. In 2002, he published The Blank Slate, The Modern Denial of Human Nature, which explored the political, moral, and emotional colorings of the concept of human nature. The Stuff of Thought, Language as a Window into Human Nature, published in 2007, discussed the ways in which language reveals our thoughts, our emotions, our social relationships. And of course, his most recent book, the subject of his lecture tonight, The Better Angels of Our Nature, Why Violence Has Declined, was published in 2011. Steven is the chair of the usage panel of the American Heritage Dictionary. He served as an editor advisor for numerous scientific, scholarly, media, and humanist organizations, including the American Association for the Advancement of Science, the National Science Foundation, American Academy of Arts and Sciences, the American Psychological Association, and the Linguistic Society of America. He's won many prizes and awards for his books, including the William James Book Prize 3 times, the Los Angeles Times Science Book Prize, and many others. He's also a humanist laureate, the 2006 Humanist of the Year. He's also the recipient of many other prizes and honorary degrees and doctorates, which I won't go into now. Steven lives in Boston and in Truro with Rebecca Neuberger-Goldstein, who's also here this evening. I think I'm right in thinking you have been dubbed America's smartest couple. I think that wonderful title. Ladies and gentlemen, I think without further ado, please join me in welcoming the 2013 Voltaire lecturer, Professor Steven Pinker.
Thank you very much, Jim. Thanks to all of you for coming, and thanks especially to the British Humanist Association for this tremendous honor, indeed this double honor, for giving the Goldstein-Pinker household a monopoly on your named lectures this year. So I will, and we will see you all in Oxford in June. Believe it or not, and I know most people do not, violence has been in decline for long stretches of time, and today we may be living in the most peaceful era in our species' existence. The decline of violence has not been steady, it has not brought rates of violence down to zero, and it is not guaranteed to continue. But I hope to persuade you that it is a persistent historical development, visible on scales from millennia to years, from wars and genocides to the treatment of children and animals. I'm going to walk you through 6 major declines of violence, try to identify their immediate causes, that is, particular historical events of the era, and then try to tie them together in terms of their ultimate causes, that is, general historical forces interacting with human nature. The first decline of violence I call the pacification process. Until around 6,000 years ago, humans everywhere lived in anarchy, without central government. What was life like in this state of nature? Well, this is a topic that thinkers have pondered literally for centuries, if not millennia. In 1651, Thomas Hobbes famously wrote that in a state of nature, the life of man is solitary, poor, nasty, brutish, and short. A century later, Jean-Jacques Rousseau countered that nothing can be more gentle than man in his primitive state. Well, both of these men were talking through their hats. Neither of them had any idea what life was like in a state of anarchy. But today we can do better, because there are two sources of evidence on rates of violence in non-state societies. The first is forensic archaeology. You can think of this as CSI Paleolithic. Namely, what proportion of prehistoric skeletons show signs of violent trauma, like bashed in skulls, decapitations, bones found with arrowheads embedded in them, or mummies found with ropes around their necks? I have found in the literature 20 such estimates. They span quite a range, but they average out to be 15%. That is, 15% of prehistoric skeletons show signs of foul play. Is 15% a high or a low number? Well, we can compare that to rates of death in warfare from some nasty modern eras, such as the United States and Europe in the 20th century with their two world wars, which come up to a rate of death in warfare of 2/3 of 1%. If we aim for the largest credible estimate and aggregate in the 20th century across the entire world, the rate of death from war, deaths on the battlefield, indirect deaths in the wake of war, such as hunger and disease, genocides, and deliberate man-made famines, we can get a rate of about 3%. And here is the rate for the world in the 21st century. You can't see the bar because it is less than one pixel high, representing a rate of 3/100%. Now, the second way of estimating rates of violence in non-state societies comes from ethnographic vital statistics. The wave of settled society, government, civilization that swept over the world from a few cradles several thousand years ago left a few pockets of the world still in anarchy, namely hunter-gatherer, hunter-horticulturalist, and other tribal societies. And ethnographers, who've lived with them for extended periods of time have tallied their demographic statistics, including their rates of death from various causes, including warfare. Here we see 27 estimates, and again, they span quite a range. I've plotted them in the conventional statistic for violence of war deaths per 100,000 people per year, and they average out to 524 deaths per 100,000 per year. That is, every year, 0.5% of the population is felled in warfare. Again, is 524 a high or a low figure? Let's compare it to some notoriously violent states in their most violent centuries, such as Germany in the 20th century with its two world wars, which comes in at a rate of about 150. Russia in the 20th century, two world wars and a very bloody civil war with a rate of 144. Japan in the 20th century, a world war that ended in not one but two nuclear strikes with a rate of 27. United States in the 20th century, two world wars and at least half a dozen foreign wars, one of whom we're up this very day marking the 10th anniversary of. But all of that adds up to less than 6 war deaths per 100,000 per year. If we strive for the highest estimate that we can for the world as a whole, again, aggregating the direct and indirect deaths from war, the man-made famines and the genocides, we can get a rate of about 60. And once again, here is the invisible bar for the 21st century, less than one pixel high, of 3/10 of a war death per 100,000 per year. So not to put too fine a point on it, but when it comes to life in a state of nature, Hobbes was right, Rousseau was wrong. The immediate cause was the rise and expansion of states, leading to the various paxes that history students are taught, the Pax Romana, Pax Islamica, Pax Hispanica, and so on. Often, when a kingdom or empire establishes control over a territory, they will try to stamp out tribal raiding and feuding. Not because the early kings and emperors had a benevolent interest in the welfare of their citizens, but rather because tribal raiding and feuding are a big nuisance, for the same reason that a farmer has an incentive to prevent his livestock from killing each other. Namely, he doesn't care about their disputes, but it's just a dead loss to him. So the first kings and emperors wanted to keep the people alive to supply them with soldiers and taxes and slaves. The second historical decline of violence can be appreciated by pondering this woodcut showing a typical day in the life in the Middle Ages. And the process that brought this mayhem under control has been called the civilizing process. It turns out that in many parts of Europe, homicide statistics go back literally centuries, and historical criminologists have plotted them over time. Here we have a number of estimates of the homicide rate in various parts of England from 1200 to 2000, plotted on a logarithmic scale from a tenth of a homicide per 100,000 per year to 1 to 10 to 100. And as you can see, these data, mainly from Manuel Eisner at the University of Cambridge, show that there's been a massive decline in the rate of English homicide. A contemporary Englishman has about 1/35th the chance of being murdered as his medieval ancestor. This is a process that took place not just in England, but everywhere where we have statistics in Europe, including Italy, the Netherlands, Germany, Switzerland, and Scandinavia. Here I've averaged those five curves to show you the decline as a whole for Western Europe. And for the sake of comparison, I've also plotted that 524 per 100,000 per year figure for non-state societies. This gap is what I call the pacification process. This further decline, the civilizing process. The name comes from a classic book by the German sociologist Norbert Elias, who argued that during the transition from the Middle Ages to modernity, there was a consolidation of central states and kingdoms out of the medieval feudal patchwork of principalities and baronies and duchies. With it, criminal justice was nationalized, and the constant feuding and brigandage and warlording of medieval knights gave way to the king's justice. Also during this era, there was a growing infrastructure of commerce. There were financial instruments, such as money and contracts, that could be recognized within the borders of the newly consolidated states. And there was a growing physical infrastructure of commerce, such as better roads and carts and instruments of timekeeping. As a result, zero-sum plunder began to give way to positive-sum trade. And that's a point that I'll return to at the end of the lecture. The third decline of violence can be appreciated by recalling some of the ways in which the first kingdoms kept law and order within their borders, namely cruel, vicious forms of corporal and capital punishment, forms of torture, execution, such as breaking on the wheel, burning at the stake, clawing with iron hooks, sawing in half, and impalement. But in a process that has been called the Humanitarian Revolution, country after country abolished the use of torture as a form of criminal punishment in a cascade that was centered in the second half of the 18th century. This includes England was at the leading edge of this development. The United States was right in the middle with the famous prohibition of cruel and unusual punishment in the Eighth Amendment to the Constitution, phraseology that was borrowed, I believe, from the English Bill of Rights. Also, during this era, there was a rapid abolition of the profligate use of the death penalty for non-lethal crimes. In 18th century England, there were 222 capital offenses on the law books, including poaching, counterfeiting, robbing a rabbit warren, being in the company of gypsies, and strong evidence of malice in a child 7 to 14 years of age. By 1861, the number of capital crimes had been reduced to 4. Similarly, in colonial and early Republican America, the death penalty was prescribed and used for theft, sodomy, bestiality, adultery, witchcraft, concealing birth, slave revolt, and counterfeiting. Here we've got a plot. Every execution that has taken place in the United States since colonial times has been meticulously documented. In colonial times, a majority of executions were for crimes other than murder. Nowadays, the only crime other than murder that has been punished by death is conspiracy to commit murder. Now, the death penalty itself has been abolished in most Western democracies, most prominently Europe. This red timeline shows the number of European countries with capital punishment. Most of the abolitions took place in the 20th century, but the blue timeline, which shows the number of European countries that have actually carried out executions, shows that well before politicians got around to striking capital punishment from the law books, their fellow citizens had pretty much lost their taste for actually executing people. And on average, 50 years elapsed between the last actual execution and the time that the lawmakers got around to formally abolishing it. Now, I know what you're all thinking. What about the United States? The United States is a conspicuous exception to this trend for the time being. At least 33 of the 50 states still have capital punishment. But even in the United States, capital punishment is a shadow of its former self. Here we have, from 1625 to the present, the rate of American executions per capita. And as you can see, it's been in precipitous decline. Nowadays, even in the United States, or even in the 33 states, mainly Texas, that still have capital punishment, about 40 people are executed every year in a country that has more than 16,000 homicides per year. Also abolished during the Humanitarian Revolution were witch hunts, religious persecution, such as burning heretics, dueling among men of honor, blood sports, debtors' prisons, and most famously of all, slavery. Slavery used to be legal everywhere on earth. No one seemed to think there was anything wrong with it. The Bible had no problem with it. So-called democratic Athens was a slaveholding society. But beginning with a trickle in the end of the 18th century, a wave was set off that eventually engulfed the entire world, and in 1980, Mauritania became the last country to abolish slavery as a legal institution. We have been now living through an unprecedented 3 decades in which slavery has not been legal anywhere on earth. What were the immediate causes of the humanitarian revolution? I think the one that gets the most quantitative support is the rise of printing and literacy. This graph shows the economic efficiency of producing a book in England from 1450 to 1850, and it shows that there was a 25-fold increase prior to the 18th century in the efficiency of manufacturing a book. That efficiency was put into practice, and in the 18th century itself, there was an exponential growth in the number of English books published per decade, a kind of early version of Moore's Law. And for the first time in the 18th century, a majority of Englishmen could read those books. That's when literacy stayed above the 50% mark. Why should literacy matter? Well, there's another name for this era, namely the Enlightenment. And it's not unreasonable to think that as knowledge replaces superstition and ignorance in a literate public, the populace is less likely to hold toxic beliefs, such as that Jews poison the wells, heretics go to hell, crop failures are caused by witches, children are possessed by the devil, which has to be beaten out of them, Africans are brutish and fit over only for slavery, and so on, and that's bound to undermine many rationales for violence. And it gives me special pleasure to share with you the following quotation from none other than Voltaire, the namesake of tonight's lecture. Those who can make you believe absurdities can make you commit atrocities. Literacy is a technology of cosmopolitanism, the mixing of peoples and ideas, leading people to have a sense that they are citizens of the world rather than of a particular tribe. And it's not implausible that as people can afford more fiction and drama and history and journalism, they, quite by accident, get into the habit of taking other people's point of view, imagining what life is like if you would have been them, and conceivably that could expand their circle of empathy and decrease their taste for cruelty, the tendency to dehumanize or demonize people not like oneself. And that's another point that I'll return to when I wrap things up at the end of the lecture. The fourth decline of violence has been called the Long Peace, and it speaks to the frequently made assertion that the 20th century was the most violent in history, an assertion that is never made with reference to any century other than the 20th, so it is basically a trend based on one data point. And it is far from clear that it is true. Now, it is certainly true that the Second World War was the most violent event in human history in terms of the number of people that were killed. It's not so clear that it was the worst thing in history, or at least unique in history, in terms of the percentage of the world's population that was that succumbed. Here we have a graph that I took from a man named Matthew White, who calls himself an atrocitologist. It comes from his book I highly recommend, The Great Big Book of Horrible Things, which includes an appendix of the 100 worst things that people have ever done to one another. And I have scaled his 100 atrocities by the population of the world at the time and plotted them on a graph from 500 BCE to 2000 CE on a logarithmic scale. And as you can see, history's worst atrocities are pretty evenly sprinkled over 2,500 years of history. World War II comes in at 9th place, and World War I doesn't even make the top 10. Now, you'll notice that the data cloud tends to funnel downward when you get closer to the 20th century. Presumably, this is not because in ancient times they only committed really big atrocities, and recently we also commit medium size and small atrocities. But it comes from another distorter of our sense of the trajectory of history, namely historical myopia. The closer you get to the present, the finer the distinctions you make, because the more likely it is that someone will have taken note of an atrocity, written it down so that today we know all about it. Many atrocities in the past, no doubt, were trees falling in the forest with no one to hear them. We can zoom in on more recent periods for which the historical record is more plentiful. And here we have the 20th century and the first decade of the 21st, and there's no hiding the fact that the 20th century did witness two horrific spikes of bloodletting centered around the two world wars. But far from being a harbinger of things to come, the Second World War was something closer to a last gasp, as the graph indicates. Leading to the period that has been called the Long Peace, the fact that since 1946 there's been a historically unprecedented decline in interstate war. That is a war with a government on each side. In fact, the most interesting statistic from this period is zero. There were no wars between the two most powerful states in the history of the world, the United States and the Soviet Union, contrary to every expert prediction that World War III was inevitable. No nuclear weapon has been used since Nagasaki, again contradicting every expert prediction that World War III would be a nuclear war that would see the end of civilization and perhaps human life itself. There have been no wars between any two great powers since the end of the Korean War in 1953. No wars between any two Western European countries, which I think to younger generations might even sound like a boring, banal, obvious fact. Like, who would ever expect, say, France and Germany to go to war? But needless to say, this is a historically unusual state of affairs. Prior to 1945, there were two new wars a year among Western European countries alone, a number that, as of 1945, went to zero and has stayed there. And there have been no wars between developed countries. That is, the 40 countries with the highest GDP per capita have not gone to war since 1945. Again, that seems almost banal. We think of wars as things that take place in those poor, undeveloped parts of the world. But for most of human history, it was the big, rich, developed states that were constantly at each other's throats. And because big, rich countries can afford big, powerful armies, they can do an awful lot of damage. Well, what about the rest of the world? In a development that I call the New Peace, the Long Peace seems to be spreading to the rest of the world. Now, recall that since 1946, there have been far fewer interstate wars, country against country. There have, however, been more civil wars. As newly independent states, often with inept governments, had to defend themselves against insurgent movements, with both sides armed, financed, and egged on by the Cold War superpowers. But after the end of the Cold War, the number of civil wars declined too. So this leads to the question, which wars kill more people? The old-fashioned wars between countries or the newfangled wars within a country, the civil wars that rose and fell in the post-war era? And this graph shows the answer. First, I'm showing for each decade since the 1950s, the rate of death from interstate wars, government against government, which, as I've mentioned, has shown a precipitous decline. Here we have the rate of death from internationalized civil wars, that is, civil wars in which a third power, like the United States or Britain, butts in on the side of the government. And here we have the rate of death from purely internal civil wars, an insurgency against a government. And as you can see, even though there was a rise and then fall in the deadliness of civil wars, they didn't come close to matching the rate of death from the old-fashioned interstate wars. There's nothing like two Leviathans chucking artillery shells at each other, bombing each other's cities, having massive tank battles to rack up really high death counts in a hurry. A group of young men with AK-47s can do a lot of damage, but not nearly as much damage as big, rich countries could do. The aggregate rate of death in wars can be visualized in the following stacked layer graph. This is a kind of graph in which the thickness of each layer corresponds to the rate of death in each of several categories of war, and the height of the entire stack represents the worldwide death toll from all forms of war combined. So, and the graph goes from 1946 to close to the present. Here we have the rate of death in colonial wars, which tapered off to zero as European empires relinquished their overseas colonies. Here we have the rate of death in interstate wars, government against government, which shows a spiky but still unmistakable downward trajectory with spikes for the Korean War, the Vietnam War, and the Iran-Iraq War. Here we have the rate of death from internal civil wars and internationalized civil wars. The entire pattern of death in war is something of a roller coaster, but it is a roller coaster with a downward trajectory, leading to the 21st century, where even the ongoing wars have an aggregate rate of death in warfare that is a fraction of what was seen in earlier eras. What were the immediate causes of the long peace and the new peace? Well, three of them were tossed out by Immanuel Kant more than 200 years ago in his essay Perpetual Peace, in which he ventured that democracy, trade, and an international community would all disincentivize leaders from dragging their countries into war. More recently, the political scientists Bruce Russett and John O'Neill have tested Kant's hypothesis in a massive regression analysis and have shown that he got it right 3 out of 3 times. All three of his putative pacifying factors increased in the second half of the 20th century, and all of them are statistical predictors of a lower chance of military disputes down the line, holding all other factors constant. Finally, there's the rights revolutions, the movements that have targeted violence on smaller scales, that have affected vulnerable sectors of the population, such as African Americans and other racial minorities, women, children, and animals. The civil rights movement put an end in the United States to the practice of lynching, which used to take place at a rate of 150 a year at the end of the 19th century. That's three African Americans burned or hanged from trees every week. By the 1950s, that had gone down to zero. More recently, the FBI has kept statistics on hate crimes against blacks, and those have all been in decline, assault and intimidation. This is not just an American phenomenon, but it seems to be a worldwide trend. Here we have the number of countries that have laws on the books that discriminate against their ethnic minorities, and that has been in decline. The blue line shows countries that have done the opposite, that have bent over backwards with remedial discrimination or affirmative action policies that give a boost to their they're underprivileged minorities. And for the past few years, there have been more countries that have tried to rebalance the scale by favoring their oppressed minorities than there are that discriminate against them. The women's rights movement has seen a radical decline in the rate of rape in most Western nations. These statistics are for the United States. The rate of rape has dropped by 80% since its peak in the United States, and I believe a similar trend has taken place in Britain. Domestic violence has also been targeted by the women's rights movement, and successfully so, again, both in the U.S. and the U.K., though these are U.S. statistics. You see a sharp drop in rates of domestic violence. And sharp drops in the most extreme form of domestic violence of all, namely uxoricide, the murder of a female romantic partner, and mariticide, the murder of a male romantic partner. In fact, in this case, you can see that the decline has been more precipitous for male victims than for female victims, showing that the women's rights movement has been very, very good for husbands. The children's rights movement has seen a decline in the use of corporal punishment in schools, paddling or strapping. In most Western countries, it has been abolished outright. In the United States, we're always a little bit behind the curve compared to Europe. But even in the United States, there's been a steady decline in the number of states that even permit strapping or paddling of children in school. Approval of spanking has declined in every Western state as measured by opinion polls. And rates of child abuse, both sexual abuse and physical abuse, and rates of bullying have all gone down in countries that keep those statistics. The animal rights movement has seen a steady decline in hunting. Again, these are figures for the United States. An increase in vegetarianism, both in the UK and in the US, and a sharp decline in the number of motion pictures in which animals were harmed. Well, now the question is, why has violence declined on so many scales of time and magnitude? Could it be that human nature itself has changed and that our tendencies toward violence have literally been bred out of us? Well, this is possible, but I doubt it, and I don't credit that with the major part of the change. For one thing, we still see violence in children. A large number of two-year-olds continue to hit, bite, and kick. In fact, the twos are the most violent stage in life. We still see violence in play violence in our little boys. One of the great, most robust human universals is play fighting in boys. And grown-up boys and many grown-up girls continue to take enormous pleasure in vicarious violence, such as murder mysteries, Greek tragedies, Shakespearean dramas, video games, ice hockey, and movies starring a certain ex-governor of California. And then there are homicidal fantasies. A number of social psychologists have asked young people the following question. Have you ever fantasized about killing someone you don't like? Well, here are the results. About 15% of women and a third of men frequently fantasize about killing people. And 60% of women and three-quarters of men at least occasionally report fantasizing about killing people. What does this say about human nature? It tells us that 25% of men are liars. A more likely possibility is that human nature is extraordinarily complex, and it has always included both inclinations toward violence and inclinations that counteract them, what Abraham Lincoln called the better angels of our nature, and that historical circumstances have increasingly brought out our better angels, favored our peaceable inclinations. Well, what am I talking about here when I refer to inclinations that encourage or counteract violence? Well, there are many motives for violence. There is no one thing called aggression. There is raw exploitation, the elimination or harming of a human that just happens to be an obstacle on the path to something that you want, resulting in rape, plunder, conquest, and the elimination of rivals. There's dominance, the urge of individuals to climb the pecking order and become alpha male, and the corresponding motive among groups for ethnic, racial, national, or religious supremacy. there's moralistic violence or revenge, the conviction that it is not just permissible but obligatory to inflict harm on someone who has committed a sin, resulting in vendettas, rough justice, and cruel punishments. And then there are utopian ideologies. Movements like militant religions, nationalism, Nazism, and communism, which justify violence by a kind of pernicious cost-benefit analysis. If you have a vision of a world that would be infinitely good forever, then you can commit as much violence as you want to bring that kingdom of heaven to earth, and you're always ahead of the game. The ends always justify the means. And anyone who stands in the way of this infinitely perfect world is infinitely evil and deserving of arbitrary punishment. As they used to say in Soviet Russia, you can't make an omelet without breaking a few eggs, ignoring the fact that human beings are not eggs. Well, that all sounds pretty depressing, but what did evolution give us on the other side to counteract those inclinations? What are the better angels of our nature? There's self-control, circuitry in the frontal lobe of the frontal lobes of the brain that can anticipate the consequences of behavior and inhibit our violent impulses. There's empathy, the ability to feel others' pain. There's the moral sense, a system of norms and taboos that regulate what you entertain doing and what just never occurs to you. And there's reason, cognitive processes that allow us every once in a while to engage in objective, detached analyses. The crucial question now is, how do we bring the psychology and history together? Which historical developments bring out our better angels and stay our hands before they can commit acts of bloodshed? The first possibility is that Hobbes got it right when he called for a Leviathan, a state and judicial system with a monopoly on the legitimate use of force. Now, the rule of law can drive down rates of violence by, first of all, neutralizing the incentives for exploitative attack. By penalizing aggression, it can cancel out the anticipated gain of a would-be aggressor. And that then has knock-on effects. It calms everyone down because not only are you deterred from attacking your neighbors, but you know that your neighbors are deterred from attacking you. And that means that you are no longer tempted by a preemptive strike. You don't have to wipe them out before they wipe you out. You don't have to maintain a belligerent, macho, tough stance to prove the credibility of your deterrent. And you no longer have to carry out vengeance after the fact because you can outsource your vengeance to a disinterested third party. And that has the additional benefit of circumventing the self-serving biases that social psychologists have shown that human beings are vulnerable to. In any human dispute, both sides always believe that their opponent's attacks are unprovoked aggression out of the blue, whereas their own attacks are justified retaliation after the fact. So no matter how many harms are committed, one side will always count an even number and say that the scales of justice have been balanced. The other side will count an odd number and figure that there's still a score to be settled. If you outsource it to a disinterested third party to mete out the justice, then those cycles of revenge and vendetta and blood feud can be nipped in the bud. The second possibility for a pacifying force is the Enlightenment idea of gentle commerce, du commerce. The principle is that plunder is a zero-sum game. Victor gets is subtracted from the well-being of the victim, whereas trade is a positive-sum game, what evolutionary biologists call reciprocal altruism, one in which everybody wins. And as improving technology allows the trade of goods and ideas over longer distances among larger groups of people and at lower cost, it provides more positive-sum games for people to play. That means that it becomes cheaper to buy things than to steal them, and other people become more valuable alive than dead. A third possibility was broached by Charles Darwin in The Descent of Man, but later given a name by Peter Singer in his book The Expanding Circle, in which both of them argue that humans are equipped by evolution with a sense of empathy, Unfortunately, by default, we only apply our empathy within a narrow circle of allies, blood relatives, and cute little fuzzy animals. But over the course of history, one can see the circle of empathy expanding from the to the village, the clan, the tribe, the nation, other races, both sexes, children, and perhaps eventually other species. Well, this just raises the question of what expanded the circle, and I think that the technologies of cosmopolitanism are a plausible cause. As people travel more, consume more history, more literature and drama, more journalism, they're apt to see other people as having inner lives just as they do. And in fact, there is some experimental evidence from the social psychology lab that when people read or hear the words of a real person, or for that matter, even a fictitious person, they will feel more sympathetic, not just to that individual, but to the entire category that that individual represents. Finally, there is the mechanism of the escalator of reason, the possibility that the growth of literacy, education, and public discourse have encouraged people to think more abstractly and more universally. They rise above their parochial vantage point. That makes it harder to privilege your own interests over someone else's just because you're you and they're not. It encourages people to step back and recognize the futility of cycles of violence, and increasingly to see violence as a problem to be solved rather than as a contest to be won. The final question that I'll raise is, if all four of these forces have worked to bring violence down, why have we been so lucky as to have four distinct forces that all seem to be pushing in the same direction? That seems too much to be a coincidence. And I think there is a common thread, namely that violence is what game theorists call a social dilemma. Namely, it's always tempting to an aggressor to exploit a victim, but of course it is ruinous, even more damaging to the victim. Now, over the long term, aggressors can become victims and vice versa. And so all parties really would be better off if somehow they could all agree to abjure violence simultaneously. The dilemma is, how do you get the other guy to refrain from violence at the same time as you do? Since if you beat your swords into plowshares, but the other guy keeps his swords as swords, then things could get ugly. One could well imagine that over the course of history, human experience and human ingenuity have gradually chipped away at this problem, just as we have gradually dealt with other scourges of the human condition, like pestilence and hunger. And the common denominator underlying these four pacifying forces is that they all work to increase the material, emotional, or cognitive incentives of all parties to avoid violence simultaneously. Well, whatever the best explanation of the decline of violence turns out to be, I think it has implications that are profound. For one thing, it calls for a reorientation of our efforts toward violence reduction from a moralistic mindset to an empirical mindset. That is, instead of just lamenting why is there war, perhaps we should ask why is there peace? Not just what are we doing wrong, but what have we been doing right? Because we have been doing something right, and it seems to me to be quite important to try to figure out what exactly it is. Also, the decline of violence calls for a reassessment of modernity, of the centuries-long trend that has eroded family, tribe, tradition, and religion, giving way to the forces of individual rights, cosmopolitanism, reason, and science. Now, everyone acknowledges that modernity has brought us many gifts: longer and healthier lives, less ignorance and superstition, richer experiences. But there's always been a current of nostalgia and romanticism that questions the price. Is it worth it if we have to live in the shadow of terrorism, genocide, world wars, and nuclear weapons? However, if despite impressions, the long-term trend, though halting and incomplete, is that violence of all kinds is decreasing, I would argue that that calls for a rehabilitation of the ideals of modernity and progress, and it's a cause for gratitude for the institutions of civilization and enlightenment, and yes, humanism, that have made it possible. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much indeed, Stephen. Okay, well, we have time for some questions and answers, and I see roving mics on either side of the hall, so let's see some hands up. So, okay, there's already two over on that side, and then gentleman here towards the middle.
Oh, hi.
Hi.
My question is sort of about how people study history. And so in your book, you take a very different approach than I think most people who look at any kind of historical record, in that you look at one topic, violence, and gather all the data in the world from every time and place that you could possibly look at. But most people, when they study history, tend to really focus narrowly on one event. Like a big historical book will be like Stalingrad or Paris 1919. And so in one of your other books, The Stuff of Thought, you talk about how the way our minds construe things is in terms of events. We don't see like a flow of history. We see individual events which we cut off and then think about those things. And do you think that this sort of way of thinking kind of percolates up to the way we actually, like, formally and even in academic circles study history? And this leads to sort of us missing a big trend like this, in that, you know, there's thousands of books on World War II, but not a lot that talk about a whole trend in violence.
Yeah.
So do you think the fact that we miss that sort of can be rooted almost like in the way our mind works?
I think there's a lot to it. I think it's a profound observation. And I think, cognitive habit that bedevils the study of violence, and which a number of quantifiers of violence have noted, is that, I'll actually give you a quote from the first scholar that tried to quantify war over time, the great British psychologist and mathematician Lewis Fry Richardson, who said in a very technical book, as he was trying to lay down his criteria for counting wars, he says, "Thinginess fails. That is, it is far from clear what this entity called a war is in terms of a discrete beginning and ending. Is World War II one war or two wars, namely one in the European theater and the Pacific theater? Did it really begin in 1939, or could it have said to have begun when Japan invaded Manchuria in, I think it was 1933? Or, for that matter, if you stand back, could you consider World War I and World War II to be just two outbreaks of one big war? And there's no correct answer to that. It is, as you note, a habit of our mind that I do explore in The Stuff of Thought, that we tend to treat time the way we treat space, namely as a continuum, and we treat events the way we treat objects, namely as discrete objects with boundaries. So that's why our record of the trends in violence is much better since 1946, because that's when organizations like Peace Research Institute of Oslo try to simply aggregate all of the deaths in war across the world, not worrying too much about when the war of such and such began or ended, just counting up the bodies. And that is what led to those graphs, that layer graph that I showed, which is a much more accurate picture than the best that I could do for 2,500 years of history, which is the 100 atrocities from Matthew White, where you really do legitimately get into disputes over, you know, do you lump, do you split, what's the beginning, what's the end, and so our notion is much more uncertain. And it is a result of the way, I think, the human mind naturally does history, which is to aggregate things into events which don't necessarily correspond to the underlying causal forces. So for that reason and a number of others, I think history, although obviously traditional narrative history is still indispensable, the numbers themselves have to be interpreted in the context of what are the plausible causes and surrounding forces. And any attempts that I or the peace researchers do kind of sits on top of a food chain where we depend on the results of the historians who drill down to particular events. But I'd like to see more quantitative history that does try to aggregate trends over time.
Thank you. Okay, come over to this side. So, gentleman here, and then we'll come back over to... You had your hand up right at the beginning. Yes, so we'll come to you next. Yeah.
You showed some fantastic evidence for a decline of violence, but you did mention at the beginning about the potential for is this going to be ongoing? Is this a permanent decline? What possible threats do you see to this being a continuing trend?
Well, it very much depends on the category of violence, because I do think that the talk and the book are, while looking for common denominators, have a recognition of heterogeneity. That is, we have different motives for violence. Violence then can be aggregated in groups of various sizes, and that how to deal with that problem is a major topic of the book. But what it means is that there isn't one answer to that question. So it depends on the category of violence. I think when it comes to institutionalized forms of violence, where governments have laws that encourage or tolerate violence, the positive trend will continue. I think there will be greater efforts worldwide to reduce rates of violence against women, domestic violence, and street violence. I think the rights of children will be increasingly recognized, less corporal punishment, less tolerance of bullying. I think that the persecution of homosexuals and of religious minorities will continue, and racial minorities will continue to decline. I think that democracies will haltingly and unevenly continue to increase. I think wars between countries will probably stay at the same level or decrease. That still leaves scope for a number of things to go wrong. I would not make a prediction that terrorism is going to end anytime soon. Terrorism is a case where a small number of actors can cause disproportionate, not so much damage, but at least awareness of damage. And in a world of 7 billion people, there are a vast number of grievances, and all it takes is a dozen underemployed young men getting together in a pool hall to form the Popular Front for the Liberation of Whatever, and to get their hands on some weapons or explosives and to continue acts of violence. For the same reason, I think civil wars, the trend has more or less been downward, as I showed on the graph, but it would be foolhardy to predict that we've seen the end of civil war. Then there are all the unknown unknowns, if I can repurpose a notorious phrase. The kinds of things that every one of which is unlikely, but any one of which could, just through the contingency of history and the fact that things can spiral out of control, could add up to risks that we can't even fathom. Some world leader climbs to power by whatever route and wants to rectify some historical injustice by taking over a territory that was illegitimately stolen or spreading some new utopian ideology. Who's to say that couldn't happen again? And if there were a massive breakdown of law and order under some of the worst-case scenarios of climate change, one could imagine that happening. Although I would add that the connection between climate stress and violence is far from an obvious one, that there have been many incidents of climate stress and resource shortages that have not led to armed conflict, and overwhelmingly the vast majority of armed conflicts have had nothing to do with resource shortages. So it's possible, but I don't identify that as a looming cloud in terms of war is going to be inevitable because of climate change. Climate change is going to bring enough misery and waste for other reasons, even if it doesn't cause war. So it's far from guaranteed that it will.
Okay. Yes, the gentleman in the blue. Oh, no, the one behind you who had his... You both have pale blue shirts, and I don't want to upset anyone.
Professor Pinger,
in the far corner.
First, thanks for such an interesting lecture. A lot of the data that you presented was on violent mortality, and do you have much on the trends over the centuries on violent morbidity? And have we just got better at saving people from violent causes of death? You know.
Yeah. The answer is no. Although we have gotten better, but that can't account for the vast majority of these trends. In general, the criminologists, in particular, but also military historians, tend to focus on deaths simply because they are discrete. They do satisfy the cognitive ideal of a event with nice, crisp boundaries. Namely, there's a corpse. People tend to notice corpses or notice people who are missing. And so homicide and deaths are usually used as a proxy for other kinds of violence, simply because it's a matter of chance whether the knife actually severs an artery or doesn't. So for every successful homicide, there are probably a lot of non-fatal assaults. Now, that ratio has changed with the in some categories with the advent of medical science, but most of those changes, of course, took place in the 20th century and even in the last couple of decades. For most of history, doctors were quacks and made people kill as many people as they saved, if not more. But even in cases where indubitably advances in medicine have increased survivorship, that is, war casualties in the richest countries like the US and the UK. The thing is that trends in war range over orders of magnitude. Survivorship is a matter of percentages. And no matter, even if you go from 10% to 90%, and it has not been anywhere that extreme, the difference between a World War II, which kills in the tens of millions, and, say, an Iraq, which in terms of the actual war killed in the thousands, just can't be compensated for by any difference in percentage of survivorship in a medical treatment. And then, of course, for many categories, medical care is pretty much irrelevant. If a city is besieged, you don't let the doctors in, together with not letting the food in, and everyone dies of starvation. So it does play a role, but it cannot account for any one of these downward trends.
Okay, so I did promise the gentleman over there, but I see that the gender balance among the questioners is somewhat skewed, but I'm not going to look for a token woman to ask a question. Go ahead, and then we'll go... and then the far corner.
I'm interested in the relationship you established between the mental tendency to want to be peaceful and the mental tendency to want to be violent. And I was just wondering, because you pointed to the Enlightenment and cosmopolitanism as one of the sort of early causes, perhaps, underlying the downward trends that you observe. And I was wondering how you see the cognitive relationship between those two competing powers and whether you think one is ultimately stronger than the other, or whether we've been able to truly suppress the more violent tendencies with those Enlightenment values?
I don't think there's an answer to the question of which one is stronger, because all of these respond to circumstances, and it's a question of what world you are plunked into. If your only defense against being being victimized, being marginalized, robbed, beaten up, maybe killed, then you've got to cultivate a macho stance of deterrence so that other people won't mess with you. If you live in a world in which you don't have to constantly watch your back, you can calm down and be more of a gentleman. Likewise, if you're in a world where you only trust your kinsmen and your tribe and everyone else is, and you just never meet a person who speaks a different language, whose skin is a different color, for that matter, who might belong to a different sect, have different network of kinship, then it's very easy to think, well, they are perpetually our enemies, or they are subhuman, and they can be killed with impunity. If you live in a world where you're rubbing shoulders with them, you're doing business with them, you're intermarrying with them, it doesn't guarantee that you'll treat them as part of your tribe, but it changes the odds. So those are just two examples of how the balance will change depending on your perception of the environment. It's one of many reasons why I argued in The Blank Slate and elsewhere that there isn't a debate as to whether nature or nurture is more important, biology or culture. It's rather that it's our nature, our biology, that allows us to create and pass on culture and in turn react to it. So both of them have to be factored into any understanding of human affairs.
Now, I've already gone over the hour, but I'll allow two last questions, and the two people who've held their hand up for the longest. So, yes, gentlemen there with the... Yes, you, and then in the very far corner there. And apologies to everyone else. We have run out of time almost.
Hi. I was wondering, are there any statistics or any sort of quantification of whether people have become more empathic? This is sort of related to your observation that bullying has gone down as well as, you know, general violence.
Sorry, bullying?
Yeah.
Yes,
has
gone
on as well as sort of general violence among adults. So is it, has any sort of study been done as to what the factors could be?
There are some contradictory data on that. There is one American social psychologist who claims that empathy has gone down, which is counterintuitive given that far fewer young people are homophobic, are racist, the bullying has gone down. But this is Jean Twenge. But her measure of empathy are things like agreeing with statements like "I am a very special person," which modern schools have kind of drilled into kids as part of the self-esteem movement. So it's not clear how seriously to take those ratings, given that overt signs of empathy seem to show that we're becoming more empathic. So I would say that at least in socially significant forms of empathy, that is how you actually treat people, it would seem indirectly that we are becoming more empathic. And you see it in countless ways, including treatment in the news. Do victims of war in other continents and of other races get sympathetic treatment? And increasingly they do. They're not just body counts. And I think many other manifestations.
Okay, so question there, and then we'll allow one more question after you. Is anyone else dying? Okay, yes, there. So, yes, so one more.
I just wanted to ask about the role of the internet. So a lot of the drivers that you talked about for the reduction in violence, connectedness, trade, education, could be accelerated by the advance of the internet. I just wondered, in the context of quite rapidly falling crime rates since the mid-1990s, whether you had anything to say about the possible relationship between the two.
Yes, well, it has been remarked that certain quite dramatic changes on the world stage, namely the Arab Spring and the color revolutions, were made possible by the internet and social media. Now, one could legitimately say whether the changes have been ones toward less violence or more violence. So that's it depends on one's prospect for how those trends will what the logical conclusion of them will be. But those would be two examples, if they do have happy endings, of widespread social change fostered by the internet. For crime, in most countries, the decline in crime was well before the internet. Internet certainly hasn't made things worse. Video games certainly have not made things worse, because the popularity of video games has gone up as the rate of crime has gone down. But over the decade scale, it would not surprise me if the internet and social media create yet another phase of cosmopolitanism and perhaps a decline in tribalism and popularity of authoritarian government.
Final question.
Hi. Is there any... Your talk focused mostly on physical violence, well, entirely nearly. Is there any study of the relationship between when physical violence goes down and, say, internal emotional distress, so things like depression, anxiety? I suppose bullying would be a form of that, you know, overtly kind of emotional. You know, has there been any study of that? I'm thinking as well, you know, people living longer, so they're having to put up with more life, I suppose. So, you know, people living in old age without retirement, high rates of depression, that kind of thing.
Yes. Well, rates of major depression have fallen in the last 15, 20 years. Those are the only data that I know of. They haven't been kept for long enough stretches of human history to answer that question. Jean Twenge, the same psychologist who has claimed that empathy has gone down, also claims that anxiety has gone up since the late 1950s. Which is, I think, actually more plausible. It wouldn't surprise me if we were more, in many ways, we're more anxious. We're worried about many more things than our parents were. We have to worry about, you know, wearing sunscreen and our carbon footprint, and what every time you order fish in a restaurant, are you depleting the world's fishery stocks? And this may even be a kind of personally painful but socially beneficial form of anxiety. Namely, you know, there really are a lot of things that go wrong, and we worry about more and more of them. So that's one speculation. In terms of to call depression and anxiety forms of violence, I think is stretching the term beyond usefulness. And even when it comes to non-physical forms of violence, of when it comes to, say, you know, insults and catty remarks and bullying in chat rooms, I don't think there's evidence that those have increased. And by a number of standards, the levels of invective, insult, rudeness were pretty high in past centuries and decades as well. So even though we don't have data for them, I'd be skeptical that there's been a compensating increase in rudeness that takes over from the outbursts of physical violence.
Thank you. And so we come to the end of proceedings. A few of us were joking before the lecture that what would happen if a fight, a scuffle, were to break out in the audience, thus disproving Stephen's thesis, and we just hoped everyone would behave themselves. It's true that Stephen has had his critics and detractors over the years, but he's the sort of person who, you know, like Richard Dawkins, when you listen to what he has to say, when you read what he's written, you realise there's a clarity of thinking, there's a logic based on scientific arguments and rationality that is very persuasive. Now, either I'm easily persuaded, or what he's saying is actually right. In any case, I think you will agree with me that we've been treated to a fascinating tour de force of powerful arguments that I think have, you know, even if we don't all agree with it, it's certainly given us a huge amount of food for thought. Please join me once again in thanking our Voltaire lecturer, Stephen Pinker.
And that's it. If you'd like to hear more lectures and extended interviews with the many guests we've had on our show, just head to poddelusion.co.uk. Thanks for listening.